Welcome back to the Greg Hughes podcast. What starts as a normal part of growing up can quickly and quietly shift into something much darker. For this week's guest, the journey with alcohol began like it does for so many. A pint with lunch in college, a full-time job to fun nights out, and a lifestyle that felt completely under control. But behind the music, the DJ booths and the radio shifts at Highland Radio, a dependency was taking hold. Today we're joined by Joe Dex. Joe joins us to share a raw, deeply honest account of his battle with alcoholism. It's a story marked by hidden struggles, job losses, the straining of relationships and severe health warnings, including a number of life-threatening seizures brought on by alcohol withdrawal. Joe takes us through the reality of the rehabilitation process, from counting down the days just to get out to the pivotal moment of true acceptance during his third stint in treatment. He opens up about the fragility of recovery, the tragic reality that not everyone makes it through, and the daily toolkit he uses now to stay sober, including the powerful rule of playing the tape to the end. Now, with newfound clarity, stability, and a focus back on making music, Joe is building a new beginning. This is a story about confidence lost and found, the reality of addiction, and what it truly takes to choose life. And as I just mentioned, our guest on the podcast today is Highland Radio's own Joe Dex. Joe, thank you very much for joining us. I really do appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Have you spoken out before or spoken publicly about your relationship with alcohol?
Not really publicly. I've spoken to friends and obviously family about it. I'd say a lot of people probably know, but I haven't, you know, like gone online and said something about it or like openly spoke about it on air or online or whatever.
All right, well, we appreciate you chatting to us, Joe. Before we get into that, though, Joe Dex, everyone knows you as Joe Dex, right? Your real name, Joe Doherty. Where did the Dex come from? I mean, it's probably obvious, right? People know your DJ background, but still interesting to hear.
Well, it kind of started, well, I got my first set of Dex when I was like 13, and I never stopped talking about it, and I kept talking about DJing and Dex and all, and one of the boys one day just turned around and said, like, would you ever shut up about Dex, Joe Dex? And it just stuck for
and
me.
And you just kept it? You liked just, it?
Yeah. Well, I was doing pirate radio at the time, so it came in handy.
Brilliant stuff. And were you working for a different pirate? Were you working for someone else's pirate radio station? You were actually transmitting yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, I had a small transmitter in the bedroom by myself. I'd done that for 6 years, from 13 till around 18 or so.
I mean, that's brilliant, isn't it? You know what, like, I know nowadays people can set up an internet channel or there's loads of different ways you can do it, but there was something so ham radio-y about getting your own aerial up and broadcasting into your own town. It must have been a great buzz.
That was brilliant. It was so amateur. Like, it was just one of the, there's an electrician living over the road from me, and he built me this 60-watt transmitter, and I hadn't a clue what it was. And he says, that'll get you broadcasting around Letterkenny. And I was like, what? So I was up in the chimney putting up the aerial, and that was just a great pastime for someone that age, from, as I said, 13 to 18, kept me out of trouble.
What was the traction like on it?
We used to have a text number, and it was pretty, I think it was like, we got maybe 4 or 5 texts a night. Maybe it was the same people all the time, but we didn't care. We were just playing tunes and having the crack. We didn't curse. We didn't really take the piss. Like, we just played music, and that was it. Like, we didn't make many money of it, so.
And were you then, so that was 13 to 18. When did you sort of get into the DJing club scene?
Well, around that time, I had been doing the teenage discos, warming up. There used to be a warm-up slot in the grill between 9 and 10 before the main DJ, who would have been Marty Friel at the time or a few other boys. But that was just to get into the grill nightclub at that age and get playing was an amazing experience. I remember my first time walking into the grill, I just fell in love with it, like the sound, the lights, everything. So I done that for a few years, and that kind of, a couple other gigs, birthday parties, usual crack kind of came up, and then I kind of started doing, I didn't really get into the kind of nightclubs and pubs until maybe 1920s, but again, it was just very rarely.
I would say you're a musical snob. Well, at least I recall that is what you were. Like, you know, you wouldn't stick on Wigfield, would you?
If I had to, if I was
being, but it would hurt you.
It would bother you.
You're a snob. Well, you were anyway. You were. I remember our chats and I was thinking, like, you know, because I was DJing around the same time And, you know, I would play anything. Anything. I'd sell my soul to the devil to get people out dancing.
Yeah.
But you're a bit snooty.
When I first started, I was, yeah, definitely. I was like, I'm not playing that. Or, you know, it was just strictly dance music, underground and all this. But the more you do pubs and clubs, the more you realise this is not working. You have to play this stuff. You want to get them dancing. It's not about you. It's about them. So it kind of does open your eyes a bit. But it didn't make it any easier. But this is grand.
Are you an alcoholic?
I am.
Are you?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All the time. You'll always be an alcoholic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? Why do you say that? Because people say it. Is it part of controlling drinking or what? Like, because it's a label you're attributing yourself. It kind of gives alcohol a dominance over you. Some might see it that way. I just want to tease out the terminology a little bit.
Yeah, well, there's different ways of saying it. I'm an alcoholic, yeah. I lost control of my drinking. Mm. So I couldn't control it anymore. When I started, I couldn't stop. Mm. That was my problem. Most people can go out and have 3 or 4 pints and go home and wake up the next morning and go to work, fine, no problem. I couldn't do that. At the start, I could. I was really much a pub drinker in my early days. I used to love going for pints.
Meet the lads, watch
meet
the football.
Meet the lads, watch football. At that time, when I first started, like early 20s, there was something on the town every night of the week. Like there was an excuse to go out every night. Monday to Sunday, there was everything. There was something on. That in itself would have been a problem back then, but I didn't see it. I just thought I'm just having the crack.
So when did you start drinking?
Not till I was 18.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, I had the radio station. That kept me occupied. The rest of my friends would have been, you know, the early teens doing... Mm.
But you waited to 18. So, like, what was your relationship with alcohol early on?
I would have used it... I kind of realised early on that it gave me this kind of confidence... that I didn't have, obviously, when I was sober, just to talk to girls and have the crack out and about. You know, it just gave me that wee boost to...
It's funny, isn't it? Because to go up and perform in front of people as a DJ,
yeah,
to broadcast from your house as a DJ, because, you know, people would judge you and have their say.
Yeah.
Like, you would presume, man, this fella's dripping in confidence.
You would, but...
But that face-to-face... You just needed that.
Well, I didn't realize I needed it until I had it. You know, when I started drinking, I realized this is brilliant.
But your experience with drinking early on is pretty much most people's drinking, though, isn't it?
I would have been, yeah. Well, I wouldn't have been overdoing it. You know, I would have done the regular Friday night drinking. We would have waited to Friday night to have a few cans you know, vodka, whatever, and then headed out to the. We wouldn't have headed down the street to about 11:30, 12 back then. But it was just regular. I wouldn't drink then for the rest of the week,
yeah,
which is normal enough, I suppose.
But I mean, that would be classified as binge drinking. But listen, yeah, yeah. This is what a lot of people do. I mean, I did the same, you know, and I was talking on the radio not so long ago, Donegal Town back in the day, there was this random Sunday night in the Abbey Hotel and it was packed. It was the nightclub night.
Yeah.
And everyone would be there to 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, you'd go home, get into bed. I'd get up at 7 o'clock for work, like 2.5, 3 hours sleep.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think I had a problem with drinking in the context of the culture of that time.
Yeah.
But doing it now.
The thought of doing that now.
The thought of doing it now would be unbelievable. That's your regular social life, I suppose, Friday nights. Then I suppose there's other nights you can go out. As you say, Letterkenny, you can pick a night to go out at any time, right? Would you have been the type that sort of would be, you know, maybe one of your mates could have 6 pints and be sound, you'd have 3 and start feeling a wee bit leery, or, you know, not leery, but drunk, or like, you know...
I was very conscious of... like, I would have been probably working, doing bits up here at the time as well, and DJing. So, I never really got, on a very rare occasion, got really full and falling about the place. Like, I was always kind of, I knew when to go home, believe it or not. Like, I always knew when I had enough, and I would always head home at a certain time. I was never one for getting into fights or falling about the place, getting sick. None of that ever really happened. It's happened the odd time, but I always knew.
Wasn't a pattern of you?
No. Yeah. So, like, I would have went out with people or met people out that would have been like that, you know, like Larry, and I would have just, I just liked sitting and having pints, watching the football, taking it easy, grand.
Because that's enjoyable. Like,
it's enjoyable.
You know, I mean, if the truth be told, if you can stop at that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, a doctor listening might say, well, that's crazy, you know, you shouldn't be. But, I mean, that's what people do. And if you know when to go home and if you leave it, then, you know, how was last night? I had a great night, a few pints, yeah. Watched the football with the lads.
That was early on. My problem started when I started drinking at home. Because I knew I was able to go out and have those 4 or 5 pints and be sensible. Because I knew I was going back home to more drink. And that's when the real drunkenness happened. You know, that was when I was like falling about.
And what age was that at? What age did that start?
That would have been probably late 20s, early 30s.
But in between then and your teens, there's the college years, right?
That would have been, I suppose that would have been the time that when the pints had a start. Like, we used to have at the college I went to in Derry, there was a Wetherspoons down the road. And they used to do a pint and a burger for £3. And I thought, at 18, I thought, this is amazing. Like, this is, I'm an adult now. I can go down and have lunch and have a pint. And of course, I always stayed. I didn't go back after lunch. I always stayed in the pub. The rest of the boys, when I just had the burger, not the pint, and headed back to college, I would have had the pint and then another pint and another pint. And by that time, it was a bus home. So that really affected college. Like, I don't even think I'd done the second year. But, so that kind of opened my eyes up to, I can just go and have
So did boozing F up college?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so it wasn't just a byproduct of no interest, it was the booze that...
I loved that course I'd done, I loved it. Yeah. But as I said, like that, at an early age, I didn't even realise at the time that drink was starting to take over.
I was
more excited about lunch coming and getting the pint and the burger.
But do you think about booze all the time?
No.
No, back then.
I would have everything.
Because sometimes I've heard people talk about alcoholism, and there's a period of whereby they obsess with it and they obsess about control of the drinking.
Mm.
So in other words, well, I'll only drink Friday, Saturday and Sunday, or I'll only drink Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then I won't drink for the rest of the week, and I'm in control of that.
Mm.
But they will spend all the days they're not drinking thinking about drinking.
Yeah.
And that's a real indication, really, that they're not controlling their drinking at all. They're trying to control it and obsessing about it, but the truth is booze has already got their claws in.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, because I was like more excited about getting to college and waiting for the lunch break to get the pint, and then most days then I was just like, oh, I can't wait till 7 o'clock now, you're finished up. And like the excitement of having pints in the evening time or going to watch football was way more than anything else.
And did you drink when you DJ'd?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, that was like, for me, it was part, like, I grew up at a time when all those DJs that I was looking up to, it was just part of it. Like, DJing and drinking was part and parcel. Like, you seen them with their bottles of vodka, their champagne, their pints, whatever. I just thought it was part of the job. I had to do it. So I don't think in my, 20 plus years of DJing, I've done a gig without having a drink.
Yeah.
Not that I was drunk, but it was just...
back to the control thing, right? Because you talked about having this discipline of not getting drunk and going home.
Mm.
And I presume there was a point when you were DJing that you backed off the booze, or would you get absolutely hammered behind the decks?
No, I tried not to.
So this is more of that control thing, if you know what I mean. You thought you were in control of this drink, really, truth be told.
But again, it goes back to that where I knew, like, the DJing for me was like a night out as well. It was like, you know, oh, I'm DJing tonight, but I'm also going to have 5 or 6 pints.
I was the same when I was DJing. It was the night out.
Yeah. And you're in control of the music.
And you're in control of the music and you're the best seat in the house.
You
felt you had the best seat in the house. What about blackouts and stuff? You talked about, you know, being very in control in public and then moved in your late 20s into the reins were off effectively in the house. But Did you have many blackouts? Did it upset people? Like, I'm thinking about sort of post-drink anxiety. Was that part of your teens and 20s?
Not so much in the early teens and 20s, but it was more, as I say, when I got into the late 20s and 30s, that's when the everyday, every night drinking at the time started, and I would have been leaving the pub pretty well on and going home to drink and waking up the next morning and not remembering things. But this, you know, if you're at the house drinking, there's no measures, there's no last calls or anything. So I would have been waking up thinking, what happened last night? And, you know, who am I texting and all this?
Because you'd be me and you were quite similar in certain ways. You'd be a nervy person.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was.
Anxiety, nerves, overthinking, that kind of stuff. Anyway, and the last thing you do is pour alcohol on that.
Exactly. You know. Which I did a lot of. But that, again, that later turned in that anxiety. I just couldn't take it anymore. So I just kept going.
Mm.
So the next day, instead of like, why am I dealing with this fear? I can just go and have more pints now. Mm. Today I'm off. At the time, I would have been working part-time too, which suited me down to the ground because I had those 4 or 5 days.
But what was it like coming up here? What was it like coming up here knowing you had a show, or say, for instance, you got a call to say, can you cover this show earlier in the day or something, right? Would you be really anxious coming up here, like borderline panic attacks, or was your anxiety maybe at home in the mornings or at night? I'm just wondering, because when my anxiety was at its very, very worst, there's about 3 years of coming here where it was an absolute nightmare. I dreaded it.
Yeah.
Unless I was behind the desk. If I was behind the desk, I was fine.
Yeah.
But there was an incident that happened here, and I was running down the stairs, got short of breath. John Bresson's show was on. I was doing the headlines, and I lost my breath and band jacks the bulletin. And after that, for 3 or 4 years, you know, if you go back and listen to tapes, my news headlines were like 60 seconds instead of 2 minutes because I just wanted to get them out and get gone. But if I was behind the desk, I was all right. If it was in control.
Yeah.
But and thank God there was no alcohol on top of that. That would have made it twice as bad. But did it affect your work or your performance? Did you lose the enjoyment of coming up here, or was this your safe space?
No, I used to be an absolute bag in there. Like, I was the same. Like, I dreaded coming up. I was just... But it was more the thought of having to sit here all day and like start coming down, or having to wait for the next drink. And it was just the nerves, the shaking, the looking like shit. And just it was, I dreaded it. On air, I kind of knew, I was able to, at the time, I was able to control the night before drinking, knowing if I was going to be on air, I need to be kind of on the ball a wee bit. But that soon after that, that became an afterthought. Like, the drink just completely took over and everything else went out the window. So this used to be my safe space. And after, you know, towards the end, or the last 5 years, I would say, it drink just completely took over everything. So I was...
And everything was built around your drinking behavior. And as you say earlier on, you know, you could have, and I presume you did say, well, I don't really have a problem because, as you mentioned, you know, I'm not getting into scraps. I'm not offending anyone. People think I'm cool or like me. I'm doing my gigs. They're successful. Work's okay. And then, so if that was affirming, if you didn't realize things were bad at that time, then you got into a relationship, and you know, it sounds like that you managed to build your drinking around that to your advantage, if that makes sense, historically.
Yeah, everything, every plan that was ever made in my life, like in my drinking life, was built around drink. How I could do it, when I could do it, what time I could do it at, how it could not affect, maybe try in my head, not affect this person or that person or my family. But everything revolved around drink. Like, it was complete and utter denial. Like, the whole this whole thing about, I'm not getting into fights, I'm not, the guards aren't coming up, I'm able to do my job. That's functioning alcoholic talk. Like,
yeah.
I was complete denial. It was never the drink's fault that things happened. It was always like, oh, well, sure, this happened. That you know, it was nothing to do with me drinking. I was still up and I was still at my work. Or you said to be there at this time, and I was there, and all. It was just complete denial. That's the only. Mm-hmm.
And that relationship, did the drink destroy that relationship?
I would say a big part of it did. Yeah, my love was for the drink. My love was for. I just wanted to. That's what I wanted to do all the time. I don't even think in this first particular relationship we maybe went on one holiday in 5 years, and that was all down to me. Just like, why would we do that when we can just go down to the pub and, you know, go for dinner here? But again, it was just everything had to revolve around having a drink.
Again, are you saying that now as Joe Dex now? At that time, everything was fine.
At the time, I was like, what am I doing wrong? There's, like, what's wrong with that? It's unbelievable. Like, yeah. It's when I think about it and all those decisions that were made. Like, I'm having this conversation with you now, but I really cannot remember. Like, most of my late 20s and 30s is a blur. Like, it's just disco lights and pints and pubs. It's like, if you ask me specific dates and things, I would be like, I don't know. But it's amazing. Like, it's when you think about it, like, my entire life was just revolving around the next drink. And
it was revolving around it and being arranged around it. Because at around about that time, too, you were working up here in Highland a couple of days a week. Now, the nature of that type of work is there's, you know, as I said a little earlier on, you could get called in for cover, or can you do this or can you do that? How did you deal with that, really, when probably the main plans that you had was for your next pint?
It was difficult, but I just had the amount of days and shows that I struggled through. Like, I used to do Sunday Sport up here, and it was 4 hours of, it was wall to wall live. Yeah. Like, it was like, there's no breaks, very little breaks. You maybe got a minute and a half break every 15 minutes, you know yourself. And it was just like I could feel in my chest panicking, and I was just and shaking, and I couldn't even cough because the mics were live. And
it's like a 4 hour panic attack.
Exactly. And like, thinking about it now, I'm getting jittery thinking about it. And like, that was the way it was. It was just constantly struggling through days.
Did you have anyone to talk to about that?
I didn't want to. Didn't want anyone telling me that maybe Joe.
But even that feeling, though, because that in and of itself is tough to deal with on your own.
No, I deep down I knew it was. It was a drink. I knew. Like,
so, in other words, you don't want to open up that Pandora's box of the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I knew it was, like, deep down, I knew it was a drink, and I knew I wasn't going to stop it. But I knew, like, if I had done it last week, I can do it this week, kind of thing. You know, I'll struggle through again. And at the end of it, the off license is there. I'll be going straight there to make all this anxiety go away. You know, that's just the way it was for.
But ironically, you were just setting up the anxiety for the next day.
It was just getting worse. Exactly, yeah. It was just a constant circle of that. Like, it was struggle through the day, try not to have a panic attack, get to the office, it'll all be better.
But you sound like a prime candidate for going down the drugs route.
Thankfully, I didn't. Yeah. Obviously, when I was younger, I dabbled in the usual crack, but it never...
It never formed part of an addiction.
No.
You didn't even take drugs regularly or casually. You did it like most of us do, but you never...
No, it never took hold of me.
Why is that? How could you show that restraint in that area? Because you know it's readily available, okay? How could you... was it a moral compass thing or...?
No, I don't think it was moral. I think it was more to do... I just thought it was... so illegal, or, you know, so like,
that's what I mean. But
the vodka done it for me. Like, vodka done everything I wanted it to do for me. Like, vodka was my main drink, and you know, you smoke a joint, or it wasn't for me.
Wasn't the buzz you wanted. Getting from booze. Yeah,
vodka just hit me, and that was
but
all.
But when you start hitting the shorts and stuff, right? As bad as beer is, it affects the body in a different way. Mm. So it really starts in an accelerated way, attacking the organs and what have you. I mean, you have a lot of people that care for you. Were you able to mask all of this, or could they see what's going on?
They could see. Like, I wasn't. First of all, I started developing psoriasis, which I never had before. This was when I
started. Is that like a skin condition or
what?
It's
like skin. It's like.
That's what I remember that. Yeah. It's sort of like dry skin, but it's in the eczema kind of space, right?
I think it is, yeah. But apparently, stress brings it on, plus alcohol, and I had both, absolutely, right, 100%. So that was the first kind of signs that were like my skin, like my body was kind of deteriorating, really. Wasn't eating, no appetite at all. I was kind of eating just to keep people, keep say my mom, I was loving.
But you've never been a big lad. So no. It's not like people were seeing the weight drop off you.
No, exactly. But again, I was just eating just for the sake of it to look like I was doing something. I didn't need the food. Like I never had an appetite. And it was just, again, it was the vodka. Just my body was just constantly just craving the alcohol. It was just running on alcohol, basically. But yeah, they were the kind of telltale signs.
So when did the penny drop for you? Because we're getting very close to the point whereby it started off as, you know, what seems regular drinking, impacted obviously on your third level. You're hitting your 30s. It certainly didn't do that relationship any favors, you know. And now you're hitting the vodka. You're masking it. Mm. You're putting on a show for your mom because obviously someone you love very much, yep, and you want her to be happy. But this is starting to affect your skin. That anxiety you talk of, no one can live long term with that. Is this now catching up on you? Is there a reality here that, you know, my drinking is a problem?
Yeah, well, we're starting to get on now to the, I started having seizures due to alcohol withdrawal. Now, this is when the first penny really, really dropped. Like I had my first seizure. I was actually driving back from the off license, and I can remember going to the off license and like feeling pins and needles on my arms and thinking, I need to get a drink. Like I am seriously getting withdrawals. Wow. Here. Yeah. This was at 7 o'clock or so in the evening. And I was like, I need to get toffee. I need to get vodka into me or I'm going to have a panic attack or something's going to happen. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the car and there was like a group of people. There was a paramedic knocking on the window and a group of people and it was an ambulance. And I genuinely thought I was dreaming. I was like, what? Like,
oh my God.
This is like, what is going on here? There's blue lights and there was the Garda Jeep behind me. And I opened, they opened the door and started asking the usual, like, what's your name? I was able to tell them my name and they asked me what date it was. I said, it was the wrong date. They asked me what year it was. I said 2017. This would have been 2022. I was like, no idea what was happening. And that was just, they do the swab at the side of the road. Obviously it was an RTC. So, thankfully, I was kind of on the road outside my house and no one was injured. That could have been a lot worse. But I was just, my body just shut down because I didn't have alcohol. It was a seizure. So that was the first real big moment. I spent a week in hospital that week on a trip and it was decided that during these times, I would say for about a year before this, there was a guy coming. I'll mention the name Hugh, and he's an addiction counselor. A lot of people listening to this who are in addiction will know that who I'm talking about. He used to come up to my house every day and give me guidance and try and help me. And while I was still drinking, and I just didn't.
And how did he come into your life? Was it
my mum? Knew him through going to mass.
Okay.
And she mentioned
to, so at this point she'd recognised you had a booze problem.
My mum knew since I was 18.
Yeah.
I think she knew early on the telltale signs were going to be there.
How honest were you with Hugh in that year?
Not at all. This guy can see through. Like he knew. Mm. He knew straight away I was.
You just saying what he wanted to hear or what you think.
Exactly. I was talking to him and then he'd leave and I'd be straight back drinking, like, so he I don't know how he done it, but he came up every single day and tried to help me, and I hated it. I hated talking about having a problem. I hated hearing that I had a problem.
Did you admit to him you had?
No, I was just every day I was fighting him, telling him, sure, well, what about this? Sure, well, sure, I'm working. Sure, I'm doing this. Sure, I'm going there. I've got a car. It was every day. It was back and forth. And he was telling me, like, I think the best way he described it was, you're on an island, you're trapped on an island, we're throwing you life vests, and you're not, you don't want to catch them, and you're going to swim back someday and drown. That's the best way he described it to me. Something like that, in a way. So that was a constant battle with him on a daily basis. So the seizure was had, and...
Was that the one in the car, your first seizure? Was it your last?
That was my first, yeah. And not my last. After that first one, I spent the week in hospital. It was decided Coonwarra at Galway was brought up. I didn't know anything about this place.
So how did you get to the fact then that this was an alcohol-caused seizure? You know, everyone around you knew, the doctors knew then, obviously, that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's different. Like, it's different when it's your family and the likes of you telling you kind of what you already know. But that was a massive scare for me. Like, that was something that, like, that was a life-changing moment for me. This is not like someone coming up to, oh, you drink too much, Joe. You were drunk last night, Joe. I didn't mind hearing that. That was whatever. I'm going to just drink anyway. But when something like that happens, like, even at my worst, at my height of drinking, I was thinking to myself, right, maybe I need to do something. So as I say, Coonwarra was mentioned in Galway.
That is a, how would you describe that? That's a addiction treatment center?
Treatment center, but it's also a detox center as well. So I didn't know this at the time, but it's 3 months, 12 weeks.
I was just fascinated before we get to that to know what the week in hospital was like without booze.
Well, I was on a drip and I was on Librium. Anyone that has alcohol addiction will know what Librium is. I don't actually know what it does, but it's given to addicts for alcohol withdrawal. So that was kind of a bit of a, it was just a week lying in bed and on a drip and taking Librium. And I think I remember at the time, like, I can't wait to get out of here to have a drink. I was probably thinking that.
So you weren't open to Galway at that point?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It was mentioned, as I said, and at the time I didn't know anything about the place. I says, you know what, I was thinking it was maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I was like,
3 months.
But I said, no bother, I'll go there. I'll shut these people up. I'll just go. Not knowing it was 3 months until maybe 2 weeks before it. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my God. But I was just given ultimatums. Like, it was, if you don't go here, you're not welcome in the house, which is totally fair.
So you did the 3 months.
I did the three months.
I'm just wondering, because you were there how many times?
Twice.
Right. I'm just wondering, because we talked earlier on about sort of this intense control to almost prove to you that you don't have a problem or you're in control of drink.
Mm.
And you can talk us through that 3 months as much as you want to. But I wonder, was that just another opportunity for you to say to your mum and the ones that love you, hey, you think I've got a drink problem? If I had a drink problem, could I go down to Galway and not drink for 3 months, please?
That's exactly was part of my thinking. I was going there to show them that I could do it. But at the same time, I was going there to shut them up. And I was going there with the intention of coming back out and saying, see, I done that. Now let me have pints at the weekend. You're allowed to make phone calls in there. I think it's like twice a week. I remember in my second month on there, being on the phone to my mum saying, I think I'm all right. Like, I think this is going well. I am going to be able to have a glass of wine with my dinner when I get out, or maybe I'll just have a couple of beers at the weekend. So that'll be great. Thinking in my head that
you had control now, yeah.
Thinking I'm grand. And if you could hear my mum on the phone, what? Like, what that I heard back, and I was like, oh, here we go again. Like,
let me ask though, see that you can leave whenever you like, can you?
Mm-hmm.
You can. So in other words, if you said stuff this, I've had enough.
Yeah.
So there was enough of you in there that wanted to do this for whatever reason. But, like, were you an outlier in that the penny hadn't dropped after being there for 5 or 6 weeks?
Yeah, I was there.
Were you saying this at any counselling sessions?
No, I was playing the game. I was telling them what they wanted to hear. I was being honest, like, in fair, I was being honest with them. I told them everything that happened with the seizures and the drinking, like all the drinking. I wasn't lying, but at the same time, by saying what needed to be said, that it would look good on me for the family meetings, which were, I think, they were.
And you were warming your mum up on that phone call. You were.
Oh, exactly. Up. I was like planting seeds, thinking maybe he's not too bad. And at the same time, I was thinking about my brother and like my group of friends too. In my head, they were all thinking, "Sure, Joe's grand. He's never fallen about drunk. He's never getting into fights. Mm-hmm. He's never in bother with the guards." They didn't see the Joe that was sitting at the house drinking a bottle of vodka every night.
And others did, yeah.
Exactly. So when the first meeting, the first family meeting happened, my mum brought up this phone call about, during the meeting you're sitting with your counsellor and your whatever family members come. For me, it was my brother and my mum. And she brought up this. He just told me on the phone the other night that he's going to be able to have a glass of wine with dinner and a few Heineken at the weekend. And me thinking my brother would have me back, like, as in to say, sure, he's grand. Like, we'll be out with him all the time. He's grand. Well, he basically ate me alive in there as well. Like, and that was a big moment for me as well, when both of them and the counsellor looked at me as if to say,
is this guy mad?
You are. They call it insanity. Like, it's called, like, alcoholism.
Yeah, but it's still denial. I mean, you still believe that you're in control.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
You know, you believe that you've got this. Even though everything in your life is pointing to the fact that you didn't. And that's your brain. That is your brain trying to say, well, I need this boost. Like, I often think people underestimate the power of the brain, or maybe I overestimate it as well. But your brain's working against you, because we do presume we and the brain are one and the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of fight or flight or anxiety attacks, or whether you get excited or whether you get nervous, like, your brain was working against you. That's what was happening. It was saying, hold on, well, I need the booze.
Aye.
So I'm going to make him think this way.
Well, I use drink to cope with everything. Like, I use it to cope with every single...
Happiness, sadness, mediocrity.
Yeah. If I had something.
Wins, losses.
Everything. Yep. Absolutely everything. If I had a gig coming up in a week's time, if I had a wedding to do, if I was coming up here to do an outside broadcast, like, the thought, when I felt any slight bit of nervousness or anxiety, I just.
But you dreaded gigs, didn't you, sometimes? Birthday parties or something like that.
I did, kinda, yeah. But again, the drink was there to help it. Like, the drink was there to. Give me the.
But I mean, like, you know, you had to work through a lot of anxiety and, you know, nerves about doing stuff and still do it, obviously using drink to help you through. But I mean, that was part of it too.
It was.
So at any point then in your 3 month stay, your first 3 months in Galway, after that family meeting, did you go, right, okay, well, I'm going to stick this out and I'm going to come out and not drink? Or were you still playing the game?
There was part of me that says, you know what, I'm going to try it. I'll get out and I'll try it. And I did. I got out and I think maybe I'd done possibly a month or two. And I'll never forget. I think I was driving back from, it was Rathmullen Beach or somewhere. And I says, you know what, I'm going to prove to myself that I can drink moderately. I'm going to buy a quart of bottle of vodka and just drink it. And then not drink the next day, and then we'll see how it goes.
And how long were you dry for at this point?
It would have been possibly a month, maybe 2 months.
So it's 4 months, 5 months in total. 3 months in, yeah.
The way I looked at it, though, it was 3 months against my will. You know, it wasn't me. If I had the choice, I might have drank in those 3 months. Mm-hmm. So 2 months by myself, maybe, possibly. So I thought, you know, I'll go in and get a quart bottle, I'll drink it tonight, and then I'll not drink tomorrow or the next day, and then that'll just prove now that I can do it myself. So I went in, I think I stopped in a shop on the way back in Remelton, and asked the boy behind the counter for a quarter bottle of vodka. And if this wasn't a sign, I don't know what it was. Like, he went to scan the bottle, and the bottle wouldn't scan. Like, he tried to scan it a few times, and it wouldn't. And I was sitting there, this is like a sign, like, I shouldn't be doing this. So he was like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll get another one. So we went and got another one scanned straight away. And I just spent the whole, that 20, 25 minutes driving from Remelton to Letterkenny, just like looking at it. I was like, I don't know. And I didn't enjoy it. Like, I felt the buzz when I drank it, and I felt like this is grand. But, you know, once you've gone through a rehab or you've been told all this, like, you're never going to enjoy a drink again.
Did you drink the next day?
I did. I drank. That was me back on it.
So, in other words, you failed your test.
Yeah, I failed the test, which I kind of knew was going to happen anyway, like, and deep down I knew, like...
Like, you were very selfish.
Yeah.
Really.
Absolutely.
Because your mom, your brother, other people in your life had put so invested so much in you and faith in you. And you, that sounds like a terrible thing because it's the drink. This is the drink's fault as well, right? But, you know, and I don't think, it's certainly not in your nature to be selfish, but you at some point you consciously had to say, well, you know what, stuff everyone, I'm having a drink.
That's exactly what it is. That is exactly what alcoholism is. Mm. You don't care about anything or anyone or anyone's feelings. It's just about you getting the drink for yourself and nothing else, like nothing else matters. It just takes over every aspect of your life.
Yeah. So this relapse, if you call it that, sort of coincided, didn't it, with COVID? So there's no pubs at home drinking. Is that the timeline?
Yeah, that would have been right. So at that time I was back full tilt on it, drinking every night. This would have been up now, and I would have been on 70 CLs or litres of vodka every evening.
How much?
70 CL or a litre bottle, depending
on... A litre bottle of vodka?
Yeah.
At that point, are you even mixing it?
No.
Are you even pouring it in the glass?
Pouring in the glass, I thought to myself, I'm not that bad to drink it out of the bottle yet.
But it must have been damaging you.
It was. Like, I could feel it. I could feel my esophagus burning.
Because there are people who have died as a result of the damage to the esophagus. Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Did you care if you died or not? Did it factor in? Did you think about it?
I was probably too far gone to really care. I had no regard for my health at all.
Like, that's what I'm saying,
I didn't really.
But did you join the dots and say this could kill me?
I did think about it, but I just thought, in my head, as long as I had drink and vodka, my body wouldn't have another seizure.
Yeah, so again, this is your brain working against you.
So this is this
with the in cahoots with the booze.
Yeah. This was my thinking. Like, the reason you had that first seizure was because it was alcohol withdrawal.
How long then were you on the booze merry-go-round before your next, you know, your next seizure or the next big moment?
I think it was probably around 6 to 7 months, maybe. I know the next seizure. Again, which I can't remember.
Can I just ask one question? Yeah, sorry, by the way, Joe, because you disappeared for 3 months. So obviously work had to know, friends, groups had to know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Was that additional pressure? So how did you then sort of people find out you were back on the drink then? Because, I mean, obviously you were in a bad state. Went away for 3 months, you come back, you're back drinking again. Of course, we're talking about how you felt in yourself, how it might have impacted people that knew exactly what you were doing at night. But what was the conversation? Can you talk about conversations that you might have had with Linda here or
they didn't know.
Friends? So that's what you masked it.
I masked it completely. Okay.
So did you become even more secretive?
Absolutely. The best thing that happened was the whole kind of COVID thing was around too. So I never
went. That's quite true. I forgot about that. Yeah.
After the first stint in Coonmore, I never really went back to pub drinking again because I didn't want people to know that I was back on it. So this excuse to drink at the house.
You talked about vodka.
Yeah.
You didn't drink any beer.
Or did you? Not really. No,
was that because of smell or
not? Well, the smell, and I just found it a waste of time just trying to get
cut straight to the chase.
Like, exactly. So six cans for me would have taken an hour, whatever, 2 hours to drink, where I can just get the vodka and get the hit straight away. Like,
for how long was you drinking completely a secret, say for your mother?
I think she probably.
That you were back on it.
She definitely knew kind of early on. We were living in the same house, obviously, so she would have seen me walking past her and gradually getting more wobbly or more like.
Were you pretending not to be drinking then?
Absolutely, yeah. Wow. It's like I used to hide, like the hiding the bottles was a big one for me. Like I used to there wasn't a, I don't think there was a space in my room where there wasn't a
bottle head somewhere.
Like a bottle head somewhere. Mm-hmm. There used to be a shelf, or there is a shelf in my room where I hold my records, but it kind of, there's a like an opening at the top, and I would say there was 3 to 4 bin bags.
How are you funding all of this?
Well, the part-time work at the time.
Because I suppose you weren't spending it on food, were you?
I wasn't spending it on food, no. It's, again, borrowing was a big thing too. I would ask friends for a lend of, say, €20 for a box of cigarettes I was smoking at the time. It was always cigarettes. Of course, that was going straight to drink. So it was constantly borrowing, paying back on a weekly basis if I didn't have the money. So that led into, Hugh was kind of still on the scene too. He knew I was back drinking.
Good old Hugh. He never gave up on you.
He never gave up. It's unbelievable. Again, as I say, anyone who knows him will know exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that led into the White Oaks, which I went to in the September.
What got you in there? Was it the seizures?
We were coming to the second. So it was the second seizure. This happened. I think this happened around, I'm not sure when it happened, but it happened in the bathroom at my house. By some miracle, our bathroom key, the key for the door went missing and it was never recovered. And my mum heard this bang one night when I was out in the bathroom, and she came in, and I don't remember any of this, but same thing, just I was lying on the ground and she said there was blood coming out of my mouth. She thought I was dying, rang the ambulance. By some, as I say about the key, if that door had been locked, it might have been a different story. So I took another seizure then for me to think, oh, right, maybe I'll give this another go. I'll give rehab another go. So White Oaks, I went into White Oaks. That's a 30 day, that's a month. Give or take.
And you lent into that a bit better, didn't
that,
you?
I did. That is different. It's a different kind of way of working they have in there. It's really intense, and the counsellors are amazing in there. And I really did think during that stint, this is it for me now. This is really, there's a better group, a smaller group of people here. They all seem to want the same, they all want to not drink again. And you're really as I said, it's really intense, and I really did get a lot out of that, out of White Oaks. It was a massive help. What happened this time with me leaving there is I got out of there in at the end of September of that year. I think it was 2021. And one of my plans was to not go back DJing, because DJing,
the two were interconnected. It's booze, a massive DJing,
yeah,
the one thing.
It's a massive trigger. Yeah. But I took a gig. I took a gig over Christmas.
So this was October grand, November grand, December grand. We're coming to the Christmas, New Year. Yeah. There's a gig going.
2 weeks before the gig, I start getting really nervous about it for some reason. It's a local gig. It's something I've been doing for 20 years. What's the big deal? But in my head, it just exploded into this mat. I hadn't DJed in years. What if the crowd don't like me? What if they don't like the music? This became a massive issue. I said, no, I'll not do it. Came to the night. I was due to start at 10 o'clock. I went into the bar at 9. And I was like, the only way I'm going to settle these nerves is to have a double vodka and coke.
But is that a different type of relapse, though? Is that a panic going, I can't let these people down, I have to do this, this is how I can do it? Or is it just another excuse to have a drink again? Do you know the last one was very calculated, the last time you relapsed and you thought you could set a challenge, you were in denial? This sounds like it was just in a moment, and maybe it's more attributable to your anxiety and the panic than alcoholism, or what? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Again, because I just used drink for everything to cope before, this just became the only option for me. And it's just the alcoholic and me saying, you know what to do here. You know how to settle these nerves. You know what'll get you through this night. Just have a wee double and you'll be grand. And of course that double went into the, I'd say by a month later, I was back on the leaders. And
were you happy? Like, I mean, did you feel like, you know, did the drink welcome you home, or were you drinking going, this is absolutely crazy, what am I doing, but I have to do this? Or were you going, you know what, here I am now, I'm back having a drink, life's good?
Yeah, it was mostly I'm back at it, but again, I wasn't enjoying it because I knew the whole drinking experience for me just revolved around hiding and sneaking and lying. Like, I became an absolute master of lying to people, to everyone, to every part of it. It was just all lies and sneakiness. And
but the thing is, like, you know, there is a familiarity with a lot of people's journey with alcohol. But, you know, I mean, maybe it impacted a previous relationship. Maybe it would have pitted out one way or other. Anyway, we don't know that. We can only talk about what we know right now. Like, it's not like you lost a lot of people. It's not like it devastated your relationships. It's not like you fell out with your mum and you can never, you know, you have a beautiful partner in Afrique. She's been with you here through a lot of this and remains with you. So this isn't a familiar catastrophic story of you being down and out, no family, no friends, no support, in an alleyway with a bottle of vodka and a round bag.
I was so unbelievably lucky with the people I had around me, like with Afrique, my mum, my brother, Hugh, all the family. Like, as you say, that a lot of people wouldn't have put up with the shit that I done, that I was putting them through. Like, they would have said, "What? Get out of this house. Like, well, who do you think you are?" I was so lucky and I was given so many chances. And maybe that's probably why, like, I knew deep down, they're not going to do anything. Like, they're like, she's not going to leave me. She's not going to kick me out of the house. I can keep going. I'll be grand. But it was just the sneakiness and the lying. It was just.
Can I ask? I think we can say it's not a secret. What's Afrique's family's business?
They own a bar.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Good shout.
Yeah. I worked that one out well, didn't I?
To really test you, like.
But like, that's it. I was like, I spoke about this before. Like, I don't really mind. Like, I don't put myself in a position to go into bars. Like, I have no business being in a bar unless working with something that's on here.
Yeah,
or maybe,
exactly.
Whatever.
So,
like,
say we did an OB or Monday night sessions at a bar or something. Yeah,
I don't. I'm distracted by other things in that situation. I'm not going to unafraid. Like, I might call and see they have a Red Bull or a Lucozade in here for the crack. I shouldn't be there. Like, it's too much of a, it's too dangerous for me to be there. With her having the bar, it's no real issue.
I know, no, but it's just a funny line.
I know.
So White Oaks, a positive experience, that Christmas relapse, for whatever reason it was, back on the vodka again. Mm-hmm. You know, your mom knows what's going on. Hugh still calling around, and the seizures happen again. I think at this point too, you have referenced that, you know, you're even testing the patients now with the people that have supported you as much as they have, because they're watching you kill yourself, right? And these are people that love you,
basically.
And, you know, I don't think they're saying, you know, what's the impact on me? How does this make me feel? They're sitting there watching someone that they obviously have a lot of time for kill themselves.
That's a line that I've heard. So, like, you are literally killing yourself, Joe. Like, and I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm here, I'm talking to you, I'm going to work, I'm driving, I'm blah, blah, blah. There's no doubt about it. Like, I got very lucky that my organs weren't
permanently
damaged.
Damaged.
With the amount of vodka I was drinking. So this was leading up until my third and final rehab in Coonwarra. So this was a big one for me because my safe space out of everywhere was probably being on air here doing my show on Saturday night. It's just something I love doing. I play whatever I want. And
well, it's what you dreamed of with your 60 hertz transmitter with a poxy aerial on the roof when you were a teenager. This was it.
Yeah. So that was my safe space. Nothing could invade it until, of course, the drink did. And there was just one Saturday night. And I was doing 10 to 1 at the time. And I think it was just the usual thing. I was one this one particular Saturday. I was really, really anxious. I'd probably been, well, I would have been drinking the night before. And I was like, I can't have a panic attack up here. What the hell am I going to do? I can't have a panic attack on air. So, or I can't have a seizure, even worse. What prevents a seizure, Joe? Oh, have a drink. So I thought, right, I'll throw a few vodkas into me. That'll settle the nerves. I'll get through the 3-hour show. Back home at one, the vodka's there waiting for me. But on this particular occasion, I just overdone it a wee bit. And I thought I was grand. I thought I was good. And then someone came into the station and said, you need to stop talking. Jesus. I was like, what are you talking about? Were you drinking? And I says, nah, what are you talking about? Doing my show. I don't think you should talk anymore. So I just got completely on the defensive. Like, what do you mean? Like, how dare you say this to me? And I'm grand and blah, blah, blah. So I hit the auto mode and the music played on. It was just the next day then when I realized what had actually happened. Like,
did you listen back?
I listened back.
Were you drunk?
It's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life.
Really?
Yeah. I was slurring my words.
And you know, listeners might go, you know, your girlfriend's threatening you potentially to leave. Your mom's saying, I'm at my wit's end, you're killing yourself. Hughes up at the house every single day. And people might go, well, how could this be? How could this be the thing? But what I suspect that sounds to me like, that was the last refuge that drink got its way into.
Yeah.
So you were dealing with, you could handle your mum, you could handle your girlfriend, you could handle your brother, you could handle Hugh. And the last refuge, that last little space on that island that you had was the radio. And that's why it became such a big deal.
It got infiltrated, and it just, that really, as bad as it sounds, me saying like that was the thing that...
No, it doesn't really, because it makes sense. As you're saying, I'm thinking, right, the final claw here, the drink, the drinks got in.
Yeah, like that's when I knew, because before that I was able to not do it here. Like I was, this was the place that I knew I couldn't do it, and it happened. And for me then, that was really like...
How long before you were in Galway?
I would say within... That was March, and funny enough, the last time I was in Galway, it'll be the 23rd of this month, 3 years ago. So wow. May 23rd I went in. So that would have happened in March, and I was in Galway in May, and this was, at this point I was, I really was kind of, after that happened, everything else kind of sunk in. Like everything that would happen with my mum and Connor and Africa and all my family, it all kind of came together, and I just thought to myself, this,
clarity, you got clarity.
Something like that, And I was absolutely blessed when I got to Galway. In Galway, you get put into groups of 12 or 13, whatever, and I was in with 12 lads and all of them had the same ambition to stop drinking, and they were the best group of lads.
But and I think this really talks to alcohol and what alcohol is and what alcohol does, because you've been able to track the 12 guys. You're one of them, right?
Yeah.
And you know what the status of those guys are. And I think really this brings home the addiction and the power of alcohol. Mm. What is the situation with that 12?
Well, there's one guy that I'm on regular contact with. He's actually working down there now in Coonwarra, Danny. It's just me and him left in the group that aren't drinking. The rest of them have all, as far as I know, gone back on it. There was another guy who's kind of outside the group. I think he was in the group behind us maybe, but the last I heard was he lasted 2 weeks and he was found dead from drink alone. And that's just one person. Like if you look at the Coonwarra stats, like there's probably a few deaths every year, like from us, like
That's unbelievable, and I think it's a testimony to what you've achieved. So that 3 months obviously was different to the previous 3 months. You restructured your life coming out, which I think really has helped you in terms of your interests, your hobbies, what you do, what you don't do. Was that something you worked out on your own, or is that part of the process of that 3 months?
Well, when I was on there, I was constantly thinking, like, I need... They tell you, like, you need a hobby or you need to do something. I was like, what's a hobby I would like to do? And something I'd never done was make music myself. Like, I was used to DJing and stuff like that. So I says, you know what, I'll give that a go when I get out. I'll see how that goes. That's become kind of a new addiction. Another thing was, like, the whole time I was down there, it was just... It felt completely different. As good and all as White Oaks was, and as good, like the first time, I can't really call the first time proper rehab because my head wasn't there. But this time, I just embraced everything that was told to me in there, and I just had this clear vision in my head the whole time, was of what I wanted to do when I got out, and like, what can I possibly do that doesn't involve anything to do with alcohol, that involves like just generally being a better person to the people around me.
How do you win the trust back though? Like, how do I know I'm not Hugh and you're filling me full of lines? How does your mum know that Joe's a master manipulator?
Yeah.
How do you, or do you ever fully rebuild that trust? And is that something that bothers you or you think about?
No, I don't know if it ever will be fully restored. Like, it probably, I don't know. I've done that much lying. I don't know if they'll believe, like, I mean, they have every right not to believe me.
Mm.
But it's just, you just have to...
You just demonstrate.
Yeah. I don't do anything that would make them question whether or not I'm having a drink or... like, there's no reason for me to, as I said before, like, there's no reason for me to be in... I used to love going to watch football. Like, that was my... I loved going to the pub to watch the football. There's no reason for me to do that now. Now, that would be a big question. Like, oh, I'm just going to watch football. They'd be like, really, like the bells would start ringing there. But I just go to work.
How close have you been coming? Have you ever come to having a drink since then? Because it's three odd years now. Or if you just got a system now whereby you know what to do, what not to do?
There's not really been any... I'll tell you, I was in Monaco
last weekend.
I didn't really think I'd struggle there because it was obviously a work thing and we were pretty busy. We went there on the Sunday and me and Lee were kind of setting up the Monday and the shows on the Tuesday morning. And I had planned to go and do my own thing on the Tuesday, which I did, and I was kind of just walking around, and I got back to the hotel room about 6:00. And I was like, what am I going to do for the evening now? So I got up again and went for another walk. And then the second time I came back from the walk, I was like, it really started hitting me here. Like, I'm on my own in a foreign country. No one is here. I'm in this apartment by myself. What would happen if? And then you just have to, I just got up straight away.
But that's brilliant though. I mean, that... Like those experiences, and I'm sure there's many of them, that proves, you should be very proud of that.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be a point, there's always going to be a point where you face little challenges like that or little question marks, but that's the proof of your recovery.
It is, but it's scary at the same time. I never really felt like that before in the 3 years of my, like, I'll be 3 years and...
Yeah, but all you did was consider.
Yeah. Well, there's a line...
I mean, don't go hard on yourself either. Like,
there's a line I heard in Coonamurra. It's called, you just play the tape to the end, and I love that line because it's like, right, so you can have that first drink, but then play the tape. How did that first drink in the past end? It started off as, I'll have the one, see how that goes, and it ended up, liter bottle of vodka straight at night. So you just, that's my kind of line. I use, like, right...
So how do you cope with, anxiety? Have you got a handle on that? How do you cope with the highs and the lows that things that were previously. Now, DJing, okay, you can avoid DJing, you can throw yourself into the music, but, you know, maybe the anxiety or the highs and the lows have dissipated without alcohol in your system, but, you know, do you have, like, have you done cognitive behavior therapy, or is there anything else that you do that helps you cope with not drinking?
Well, the anxiety has definitely lessened without alcohol. That was obviously a massive issue. Like, that was one of the leading causes of it. So it's definitely, like, I've become more confident in myself since I stopped drinking, because when I was drinking and trying to do work, I was, you're making mistakes. You're not fully engaged in what you're doing. So you're constantly doubting yourself. But when I stopped drinking, you without that anxiety, without that, you know, the fear you get from being on the drink the day before, like, all of that's gone now. So all the anxiety went. It's just a more kind of calm.
Less noise.
I don't put myself in situations that I'll get anxious about. It's just, yeah.
Do you think you will go back into pubs? Do you think you'll go back into DJing?
It's very risky. That's the big, like, I don't think I'm quite ready yet to go back DJing. And that thing, that Monaco situation with me just sitting in an apartment by myself, that thought, that wee thing that went off in my head made me just realise you're definitely not ready to go back DJing, because for me to be sitting in a pub DJing and a bit of anxiety kicking in or something, it's just handy for me to just ask for a double vodka, you know, so.
And you know, you are more conscious of your body health as well now, aren't you? So
Are you
starting the gym?
I'm thinking about it next week. Well, I am starting next week, yeah. Imagine. That's the thing. I used to go to the gym in the height of my drinking. Like, it was all weights as well. So I was going in, doing an hour's weight training, and then going back home and just drinking. I was just undoing all the work. Like, but it was probably something that I was able to say, sure, I'm going to the gym. Sure, I'm not that bad, you know.
Let's wrap up with the music, because you talk of the music creation, and, you know, how do you release your music? What do you hope to do with that?
At the minute, it's a hobby. You know, it's something. I used to leave work at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and go home and drink. This is something else to do now. I just go home and open the laptop or open the computer and spend a couple hours just making music.
Can you play an instrument?
I can. Well, I know the notes of a keyboard.
Right.
But
so, if you want to do a piano riff, which might, you know, you can do that yourself as well.
It's mostly just me kind of goofing, and then you can quantize it after and all.
Well, you know how you used to be a snob about music.
Yeah.
What's your feelings now about AI's involvement in music creation?
I despise it. Well, if you had asked me that question before I was making music, I would have said I don't mind. But and most people probably don't mind, like, they don't really care. But there's a lot of work that goes into making a tune. Like, and when you see someone just putting in a prompt and a full song comes out. Yeah. Anyway, that's for another podcast.
Well, Joe, anything you want to add? It's been a really interesting conversation, and I think it's interesting in that, you know, there's a lot of tropes, and I don't mean that in a negative way, you know, and some of them are present here in terms of rock bottoms and stuff, but yours is a different type of story, because sometimes you have to lose everything. Sometimes you have to lose everything before you sort of take that step. Yours is a little bit different in that you perhaps nearly did, but you haven't. And you've had, you know, good people around you, as I mentioned, to support you. Would you ever go into sort of helping other people, or are you not there yet? Because I think sometimes you have to make sure you're 100%.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't be 100% about help. Like, I would absolutely.
I know you'd never turn down a convo, but.
Yeah, I would absolutely guide someone if they ever came to me and thinking, like, you know, they had a problem. I would completely guide them in the right direction. I don't think I'm 100% for me to give them advice on, you know, fully what to do, but there is loads of help out there, and I was very lucky, as I say, with the people I had around me.
And you're in a really good place now, you know. You're happy, you've got that love of your music, you've got wonderful people around you, you know, you've got your job which you love, you've got your son. I mean, there's so much going for you, isn't it? I mean, you know, how could you? You would never ever want to go back.
This is it, like, and this is why I'm so lucky. Like one drink can undo one for me. One single drink,
and that's proven.
It can undo everything. Like, it's, I know it's happened before. Maybe it took that to happen before for me to realize. Mm. Like, this is where it leads. So that is a massive incentive for me to, like, never do it again, because I know what I'll lose, and it'll be a lot. But again, like, there is people out there. I've seen it. I see it. You know, someone has a problem, but it's not for me to say to them. The biggest thing for me in this whole journey was, you have to want to stop yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to Coonmore the first time. I went to White Oaks. I wasn't fully ready to stop. I was ready to cut down. I was ready to...
But it's the commitment to not stopping was amazing.
Yeah.
The commitment to put 3 months in down there with a plan.
That's the insanity of it.
You know, or the power. And you know, I think it's just really telling and thinking on for those other lads that were part of your group, and particularly for the lad that lost his life. You know, that's a perfect example that you're the minority and lucky. But I mean, obviously, it's because of you and your personality and your commitment and the support of those around you. Joe, it's been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it.
Brilliant, Greg. Thanks for having me. It's first time talking about it sort of publicly, like, so it was different. Good to get it out.
And good stuff.
Thanks for having me on.
Joe Dex, a.k.a. Joe Doherty, or Joe Doherty, a.k.a. Joe Dex. Thanks very much indeed. And a big thanks once again to Joe Dex. I hope you enjoyed that podcast, and I think we can all praise Joe for his bravery. It's not easy to speak out, but he did so well there. We've got some really excellent podcasts coming up for you over the coming weeks and months. So if you enjoyed today's show, please like and subscribe if you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or come back here to highlandradio.com if that's where you found us. Any feedback, suggestions, guest suggestions, in fact, you can contact the researcher and producer of this podcast, that is Caroline Orr, and you can email her, Caroline Orr at highlandradio.com. We'll be back next week.